Welcome to the Engage and Empower podcast. Behind every successful company is an intentional and innovative approach to empowering your most valuable asset, your people. Join me in having conversations with people and talent leaders as we share our journeys and unpack what it takes to build strong, cohesive teams and employee experiences. From executives at early stage startups to innovators at large public companies, we'll capture the compelling stories of the people behind people teams. Hey everyone, thanks so much for tuning in to the Engage and Empower podcast. I'm your host, Resika Rajagopalan, and today I am beyond thrilled to be chatting with the SVP of People at Drizly, Gabriella McManus. So Gabrielle and I go way back. I met her early on in my HR days, and I actually consider her one of my most influential mentors. So I feel incredibly lucky to know her. Gabrielle, thank you so much for making time for the show. It's always a pleasure chatting with you. If you wouldn't mind just getting us started by giving listeners just a quick background and introduction on you, that would be great.
Thank you so much, Resika. It's also just such an honor to be on here. You know, I've loved the time that we've got to spend together. So a little bit about myself and journey. I've been at Drizly now since about 2.5 years, getting close to 3 years, actually. And my journey's been anything but linear. So I think oftentimes you hear about people that get into the HR space and either they knew that they wanted to do it or they start off in talent acquisition. For me, it was, you know, just kind of like throwing things out to the universe, doing things that I really enjoy doing. And then I just found my way in people operations. So I started off in sales at a pretty rapid growing company. And from there, ended up identifying that we just had a lot of just a lack of efficiencies from our hiring processes, our training. And it was at the time where the economy was in a downturn. So from a financial perspective, it was, you know, there were so many people that were out of work, it was easy to hire. But at the same time, too, it was incredibly inefficient because turnover was pretty high, the involuntary side. So I saw this opportunity to kind of like look at the hiring process, what was going on in it, and then start almost this like training pod where people would come in, I would be able to work with them, coach them, manage them, train them up, and really get them prepared for the sales floor. And it ended up working out really, really well. So well, in fact, that they decided to pivot everything through this pilot program. And then I needed support, I needed help. So we started putting team leads in there. So purely from a volume play, it was like, I had to train these team leads very, very quickly on how to look at the data to be able to pinpoint what you should be coaching on and where you should coach, how to do effective coaching. And within a few months, that translated into a management training program. Because what they found was people that had gone through team leads, through the training pod, if I'm learning something, how can I share it with others? And oftentimes when we were doing those sales trainings, even something simple like objection trainings, like what are the things we're getting stuck on? How can we share that? But it's funny now to think that something as simple as how do we counter these objections ended up being like a key pivotal moment that shifted my entire career. So it ended up becoming essentially the de facto management training program for the company. Uh-huh. And then very quickly, I realized that that was what I was passionate about because I've always loved being able to impact people or find programs, products, services that really just make people's lives a little bit better. And what I found was when I would work with these team leads and then work with these managers, their impact on the people that were there day to day was just really massive, right? Like you could have people working at the same company having completely different experiences just based on who they reported into. And again, that's pretty commonplace now and very widely understood in the HR space. But again, coming from sales, it was something that I just kept noticing these patterns. And I'm like, what's going on? Why are some people just like really able to get more from humans and maximize their potential? And then others following the same type of guidelines, the same type of goals, are just like diminishing them, where you're not getting the same, yielding the same results. And we're seeing higher turnover on one side over another side. So very quickly, I started becoming just fascinated with leadership and the power that leadership had on people around them. So that's what kind of started me down the people operations path. So I started with leadership development, went back to school for that, just organizational design, leadership development. And then from there, ended up moving into the tech space. And that was my first role in L&D. And at the time, I remember someone reaching out to me asking if, you know, they had heard about the program that I had built at the sales company. And they said, you know, that's phenomenal. Like, would you be a leadership development? I think initially my first, I was like progression path coach, and you'll be in charge of everyone's progression and leadership development. And I remember being floored because I didn't think that was a role. I was like, oh, that's a job that people can get. Like this thing that I do on the side could be my full-time job.
Totally.
And so that's kind of how I fell into people operations in that space. At that company, at the tech company, I was the one of two people. We were hired on the same day. One person did more talent acquisition and I was doing the development side, but we were the first people on a people team. So there were so many things from classic HR, benefits, you know, employee relations pieces, exits, and just so many different facilities that kind of fell under there that we became the catch-all for it. So I started becoming really, really intrigued. And I'm just someone who's naturally curious and likes to meet different people. So through that discovery, I started kind of expanding into other sections of people operations. And then, you know, fast forward 10 years later, and here I am at Drizly.
I love that story because I think it really shows the value of investing in your people and in enablement early, so much so that you've decided to make an entire career out of it. So what a story. It's often said that people leave managers and not companies. So, you know, it doesn't matter. You could work at the best company in the world. And if your manager doesn't enable you with the right tools, with strong onboarding, with ongoing feedback, the team isn't going to win and it's not going to feel cohesive. It's not going to feel fun and safe and all of those other things. So I love how you're able to recognize the impact of the work that you were doing with the sales team at that first job and then build an entire career out of it. So you were really able to build upon your learning and development work at Intelligently, where you created and facilitated curriculums and programs for emerging leaders and new managers. When I think back, that's actually how we met. I remember I was looking for support in thinking through learning and development programs for managers at my company at the time, and I loved everything that you were working on. It seemed so relevant and applicable and simple, none of the dry and complex content that I'd seen in the past, but really simple yet effective framework strategies and concepts that managers could mull over and easily use and apply in their day-to-day. I know I can speak for myself and others when I say that I genuinely saw how much of an impact your modules made on both myself and other managers as they led their team. So I'm curious, how did you think about building the curriculum for these groups? Like, what went into your initial thought process there? How did you decide on what the most important concepts were to include in, you know, a module like that?
Yeah. Well, so between the sales company and Intelligently, I was at a company called Infusionsoft, and that's where I got my first like L&D role. But it was really focused on leadership development. And what I loved is there was an opportunity to really try to find, like, it was great because I was able to curate all the great content out there because there's such phenomenal content that exists. And I think there's a natural tendency for a lot of companies, and I see this a lot specifically in the tech space, where we really want to have something that's like internally branded, right? Like everyone wants to create their own models or their own ways of thinking about things. And what I found with some of these is that why recreate the wheel? You know, going into Intelligent, when I came to Boston, Intelligently itself did exist. We really refined the content and kind of like shifted into the programs and what was there. But I think what's interesting about people, when you think about management and leadership fundamentals, and again, and looking at those two buckets very separately, but there's certain things that regardless of what level you are, how long you've been doing it, that challenges are really similar, right? So at the most fundamental piece, when you are in a managerial role, you're getting results through others. So you're going to have the same issues that pop up, whether you are getting results from someone at the most senior level or really entry level. So typically those are like, how do I even goal set, right? How do I set the vision? Like, what are we going after? How do we create that path? How do you close that loop with someone, right? To make sure that you're wrapping up the conversation, that they know their learnings and they know how they can look forward. How do you coach them? How do you provide feedback? So those seem to be like the basic tenets that you're going to see across the board. And, you know, and I don't think these are surprising topics for anyone, because usually if you're going to read a management book, they're going to talk about that, right? They're going to talk about holding people accountable, motivating others, having tough conversations, giving feedback. So that became kind of the core tenets of the themes that we would focus on. And then from there, with the companies we would work with, you know, we would customize different programs. What was interesting about the Intelligently days was really bring it back to fundamentals. So this might sound silly, but when I think of, so my family's a big soccer family. And what I think is so interesting is if you're watching, you know, the World Cup where people play at like a very high level, you see that the drills they're doing are the same drills that they teach five-year-olds to do, right? Like sure, toe taps, yeah. Side to sides. You know, those are the same drills. And so I think of it the same way with some of these, you know, these managerial principles and leadership principles. You know, there's certain just like key tenets with how you give someone feedback. Now, you might look different, whether you're giving feedback to someone who's in an hourly entry level, very tactical role versus someone who's an executive at a Fortune 500. But at the same time too, like there's certain drills and certain fundamentals that come with those. So for me, it was really around, let's find the content that's really tried and true, that's research-based. And one of the reasons I really wanted things that were data-driven and research-based is it was mainly because at Intelligently, we mainly served tech companies. And so you have a lot of different personalities. So whenever you have something that's like training can be really difficult to measure the ROI on that, right? Especially leadership development training. What I find with leadership development is when it works, when leadership is phenomenal, it feels like everything is humming, right?
Right.
But when there's poor leadership, you can easily point to the poor leadership. So I wanted to make sure we had programs that were tried and true, because I wanted to make sure that we were able to like articulate the benefits to people of all personalities, for people that were naturally inclined to believe in development and training, and for people that were like, show me the ROI. I want to measure the results of this. So because of that, I always went back to frameworks where they were very research-backed, and I could go back and say, like, here's the research on it, here's what we've seen, and things that had stood the test of time, because technology has shifted a lot. So there were some kind of like key tenets that we would go after. The other piece was, you know, a lot of companies do a great job of creating their own content and branding their own content. Intelligently was such a boutique small company that while I did create different models and frameworks, what I found was, and this also kind of ties into my own belief on learning and development, there's so many things that, you know, and I'm sure you've seen this with the models that you teach and that you've worked with. There's so many things that you're like, oh, this is kind of like that model. They just changed this word. Right. Oh, and that one's just like that model. Oh, this one's like they zoomed in, that one they zoomed out. So for me, what's difficult is when you're teaching someone something or you're trying to develop in something, and this happens to all of us, sometimes you have to hear it in different ways. You have to hear it in different voices. Some people are going to read it and it's going to stick. Some people need to see it in action. But especially if you are able to curate really strong content, then even if someone doesn't grasp it the first time or the second time, or even if they get it right away, but then they forget and they want to come back to it, I didn't want them to be beholden to Intelligently to always have to come back to us. And also from a scalability standpoint, I just figured it was like, hey, we can teach it, but here's the person that wrote the book on it, right? Or here's a few different ways of applying it, or here's where you can get quick hits on it. So our approach was more around curating content. And then we would supplement and I would create things on top of what we had curated from kind of like, you know, the key influencers in the leadership space.
Yeah, those are some really good points. So the point on using research-backed frameworks being a good way for you to get that buy-in from your participants that, okay, this is legit, this is tried and true, and also something that people can refer back to later. I've also found that these frameworks at times are what makes things sticky. Like, you can talk about how to give feedback 100 different ways or how to delegate 100 times, but sometimes it's that one framework that actually gets it to stick so that when you go through the framework, it's like a quick gut check every time. And the best part is when it works, you know how to explain it to someone else in a way that, again, is simple and applicable. At least that's how I've grown to love modules that you've talked about in the past, like situational leadership and effective delegation, or something as simple as using the SBI model or situation behavior impact model to give feedback. I find that, you know, you go through it, it's a gut check, it works, it's easy to explain. And then, you know, when you do explain it, your managers will continue to explain that and share that with other managers. So it just continues to grow its impact. And so I love that. I also love the point that you made about leadership just coming down to doing the same types of drills over and over as you do, you know, as a soccer player or any other athlete. As a VP of people, you're still leaning on a number of the same core skills I'm sure you're using at the manager level. And as such, I'm sure a lot of your trainings also mirror many of those same concepts. And so I'm curious, as you are designing a lot of these programs for executives or folks that have gone through these topics and frameworks in the past, how do you design these programs so that they still feel impactful and not repetitive and more of the same thing over and over again?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's getting really, really clear on what are the outcomes that you want, and then what are the best ways to achieve those outcomes? Because while I say I kind of grew up in the L&D space, I'd be the first one to tell you that I don't think that episodic programs solve everything, right? I think it's a mix of, you know, a lot of people have heard of the 70-20-10 rule, right? When it comes to learning and development. So it's more of a, how can you teach this? Then how can you have people practice it? And then how do you hold them accountable and create opportunities for them to test it out in their day-to-day? So that's kind of like the model that I think through. So when it comes to even, like you said, senior execs and getting them engaged, I think it's getting really, really clear on what are we trying to achieve? And then let them know that this is, you know, with most senior people, I think they want to understand the why. Well, most people want to understand the why, but especially if you're looking at people where time is such a finite resource, you want to be really, really clear and really intentional around the time. And it's like, this is what we're going to accomplish. This is how we're going after that. And I think where I've seen some people falter is sometimes people feel that the more senior the person you're working with, that you actually have to have more content, right? So I've often seen people that are like junior in their career, more mid-level in their career, when they're in the L&D space, they almost overthink it when they're creating trainings for execs. And what I found is that the opposite is true. So often they're just moving so quickly, creating the space to really think and get into the problems are actually more engaging than not. And I try to mimic real world problems wherever we can. So if we're really trying to solve, you know, big meaty issue, I don't know, like, let's call this like scenario one, that's something we're going after, then what are the different ways that we could, what are the different learning methodologies? Because I don't do kind of a one-to-many type training, but how do you engage people in a training and have them really unpack things? So I think scenario-based, small groups, reflection, you know, you've been intelligent, so you know, reflection is one of my favorite pieces. So just giving people time to ask them a question and actually reflect and jot things down and then share. So to me, like those are some of the basic tenets of like how you can get someone really, really engaged is, you know, just simple pieces, like make sure they understand the benefit of why they're doing this. What are the objectives they're going to get from, you know, said training? What's the follow-up and how are they going to be held accountable to this? So you can really operationalize that learning long-term for them. And then once in that, you know, if it is a training or an L&D session, once you're in that, making sure that you're giving people the opportunity to each speak, to participate, to reflect, whether it's in a virtual setting or in a live session. But again, I think even, you know, my secret trick for everyone is whenever you're going to ask a question, there are some people that think really quickly on the fly and some people that want to ponder and think. And so oftentimes in trainings, you'll see like 20% of the team will answer all the questions. And then it makes it a little awkward for the facilitator because you're calling on people and you know if they're ready to answer or not. So my trick has always been, you know, whatever the question is, even if it's a small icebreaker question, but make it something relevant and thought-provoking, give people 1 to 3 minutes to reflect silently and write it down. And then once they do that, depending on the size of the group, I have them pair share, like just turn share with a pair. Because just by getting someone talking, even if they're only talking to the person next to them, you're actually like, it's the chances of them getting more engaged and talking more throughout the training are going to be higher. So I do the reflection, the pair share, and then like open it up. And even little questions like, what surprises you? You know, what resonated for you? Like those are simple open-ended questions that if you're really intentional and curious, you know, I think a strong facilitator can really have a powerful session with senior leaders. What I find interesting from a leveling perspective is when I work with more, it really depends on the content and the objectives of the training. But when I work with people that are more junior, sometimes they really want more of the step-by-step, like tactical pieces. And what I think is really interesting about manager training is for new managers, I typically get, give us the answers. I'm a new manager. I want to do it right. Give me the answer. And what I love is when people start getting more senior, I think that shifts from give me the answer to I want to ask better questions. What are the right questions I should be asking? And that to me is one of the most powerful mindset shifts.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I'm not going to lie. When I went to my first leadership development program, I swear to God, I was like, cool. So I'm going to learn the 10 different things that I need to do to be a perfect manager. And then I'm going to check them all off and it'll be great. And I quickly learned it was a lot less about the things that people were learning and much more about the introspective work that went along with it. Like, you know, who am I as an authentic leader? Why do I show up in this way or that way for my team? How did I approach this particular problem? And what was great about that? What was the shadow side of that approach? So I definitely hear you on that shift that a lot of new managers have to more experienced managers where, you know, you go from, okay, give me the list of things I need to do to more of that reflection and asking more of those broad introspective questions. So I think that makes a lot of sense. I also really like the emphasis that you make on pair sharing and building that community, because I think that's actually what makes these topics so great to talk about. You know, it's not necessarily just about talking about vision setting in a vacuum
that's, you know, that's very helpful. But, you know, what's a lot more helpful and a lot more meaningful is saying, you know, as a head of marketing, how do you think about building mission and vision for your team? And, you know, continuing the conversation with the head of product and saying, okay, well, how do you think about that? Right. And what works for you? And, you know, how have you thought about navigating this particular problem that you're having on your team? I think that holistic approach is really where you start to see people and talent get integrated into your strategic vision, integrated into the way that you solve a lot of these larger issues and these larger challenges that you have as a company. And that's really when the two kind of come together. And so I think your approach of pair sharing and having these conversations is really where you're able to build these forums where your executives and other leaders can have conversations around these topics where they're both learning a lot of these core skills, but they're also sharing how they think about these things, how they show up in certain situations. And then everyone's just learning from each other and it's great.
I think, I think even back to my first role when I was at that large sales company and I kind of like grew up through the management ranks and then started that training pod, one of the simplest things that I used to do is I would observe someone, give someone feedback, or I would have someone give someone feedback. And even if I couldn't observe it, I would go up to the person that received the feedback and just say, hey, you know, I'm just, you know, just kind of almost like quality assurance, right? It was a quality check. Like, what was the biggest thing you took away from that? And that became a habit that I would do all the time. So people weren't surprised by it. They weren't like put on guard by it because they knew, oh, Gabriella was just going to check in on like the biggest takeaway. And I can't tell you how many times I would be able to go back to the manager, the person that gave the feedback and said, what's the one thing you wanted them to walk out of that conversation with? And so often we want to give so much feedback, right? Like you could do this different and this different. I can't tell you how many times what the person received and what the person was trying to deliver were totally off base. Right? Or they weren't even there. Maybe they were in the similar ballparks, but it was just received really differently. And that sometimes can be so powerful going back to the person that gave the feedback to say, that's actually not what they got from that. So like, how could we like think about how we deliver it? So there's all these small little ways I think that you can really think of how is it being received. And so that's something easy that managers even doing pair sharing where it's like, hey, I'm giving my team feedback on this. You give your team feedback on that. And let's just like check with our own teammates just to see what they received and how they received it. Because I think that just makes it's like a good way of owning your own development and your own path. Because I think at so many companies, the expectation is that people want to develop and people want to be developed, but companies can't build everything, right? Like you're phenomenal at what you do, right? And I know some of the content that you've built. I think you're just such a phenomenal facilitator and you're a great listener. Just a huge asset, but you also can't build a training for everything, right? It's more around how do you build the muscle for people to be curious and figure out what like to go and give them a toolbox so they can go into that toolbox and figure out the answer with those tools. So I think it's that to me is one of the different pieces of like more of a traditional training, like facilitating the behaviors and the habits that you believe will make them a better leader long-term versus kind of almost enabling people to only come to you because you have the answers.
That's a pretty neat tactic. I'll have to figure out how to do that remotely, but I like it. I often joke that I'm constantly finding ways to work myself out of a job. Like I want to build things in a way where you won't need me in the future. So I totally agree with what you're saying. You want to really build that culture of autonomy where people are taking lead on their own growth. And as a part of that, have the tools to do that. So very cool. So shifting gears to your most recent gig, as you started your role at Drizly, leading up the people and talent team, a very different type of role from, you know, your more concentrated L&D role at Intelligently. At this point now, you know, you jumped right into managing recruiting, people operations, building those core systems, managing an office move. What did you do to prepare for that? Like mentally, how did you go about setting yourself up for success as you juggled all of these different pieces? And how did you think through the prioritization of, you know, all these different things?
Yeah. So my time at Infusionsoft really, I think, helped prepare me for that because while, you know, I was one of the first people on the people team. So even though we didn't have a lot of those functions, we were very rapidly growing and we became the catch-all. So I think I got to see how to move very quickly in that space. And again, being curious and never having done it, I really started to build a network in people operations. So when I came into Drizly, it's funny because the role that we thought I was going to do, and I remember looking at kind of my, when we looked at the job description, was like 25% HR, 25% talent acquisition, and 50% leadership development. And I can tell you completely like none like that. My first year looked nothing like that. In fact, I'm in year three and it's starting to look a little bit more like that, but it's still not there. So one of the things that was really interesting, and first off, I have to credit the leadership team at Drizly because the founders were really great about you know, just giving them that space to meet with people and discover. Because if someone's coming in with preconceived notions and they start, like, for anyone that you're bringing on, you know, just giving them that space to meet with people and discover. Because if someone's coming in with preconceived notions and they start, like, implementing plans from day one, I feel like you're already going to be at a loss, because they're not really giving themselves that space to, like, pick up the nuances from the company and from that culture. So, you know, really love the fact that I had that space just to really learn about the company. And one thing that I found was that while at the leadership level, there was a lot of alignment in regards to the company and directionally where the company was going, when I talked to people across the company, there was less clarity, right? Like, mm-hmm. I think that there was an opportunity for some people to understand how their roles and their work impacted the bigger picture. I think some people were confused as to what that bigger picture was. And I think people's understanding of that bigger picture was very much dependent on the department head that they worked for or the manager they worked for. Sure. So it was about my second month, we started working on the Drizly DNA, which was basically the Drizly vision. Vision being kind of like your long-term purpose, your five-year mission, and then your core values. And so that's kind of how we set it up. And then the strategic imperatives that would get us to our mission. So we went through that entire process. It took, done well, I think it takes several months. So we rolled that out in June of 2018. And I would say that was one of the best exercises that we did, because not only did it help align the company internally, but even, you know, so small things from a talent acquisition side, if we were going to hire people, I wanted to be able to sit there and say, okay, what kinds of people are we hiring at Drizly, right? Like, what's our employer brand? Who are we attracting? Who aren't we attracting? So without having that internal vision, it was almost impossible for me to go out to market and say, this is the person we need. Because I'm like, I don't know who we need. Right, who do we have? Right. Like, who's our culture? What's our DNA? So that exercise, while some people might think that company vision and strategy are removed from people operations, I think it's absolutely core to people operations to be part of that conversation, to lead that conversation if it doesn't exist, but definitely to be there, because that trickles into everything that you do, because your employer brand needs to be tied to your company strategy, right? Like, your values influence the people. And then what's your employer value prop, right? And so then when you think about that employee value prop, you have to make sure that you are living it and breathing it internally every day, because your employees will call you out on it if you're not, right? It's one thing, you can't promise the world externally and then shift it when they're internally. So for me, that's what we started with. And I was like, okay, this is going to solve a lot of problems. A, it's going to help us define our employer value prop, which will then help shape the candidate experience. But more importantly, it's going to really help anchor people into, you know, why their work is important and give them that line of sight. So the reason that I love starting kind of with that clear strategy, that clear DNA, is people want to feel like they have impact. So kind of we've already talked about that one. B, I also found that in some areas, we were moving a little bit slower than we would have liked. And the reason was there was a lack of clarity on who the key decision makers were for some different roles. And I think it was, so that kind of trickled into a few different pieces, but there was like this idea of even leveling, like what level should own what decisions? Like, how should you be thinking about scope and role? So not that there has to be a clear cut, like, oh, this is an 18-month decision, so you're not allowed to take that on. But usually when you think about it, a manager is really managing typically a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month. They're not really going to be thinking out 3 years in the future. Well, if you have a VP that's managing day-to-day, week-to-week, then you're not really setting yourself up for success for the future. And then also by having that really clear vision and the clear mission and what we were trying to achieve, one of the goals was to empower every employee with the information that they needed. So if they were ever between a decision, that was a decision within their scope, that they could sit there and say, well, I know the company is going after this. So based on this, this is the way I would lean. Now, maybe they make that decision on their own, or they like go and vet it out with their manager or any other stakeholders. But at the same time too, it's coming more from a place of power where they're saying, hey, I've read this. This is what I think we should do, versus just always going to someone saying, okay, I'm at a crossroads. What do I do? So that's kind of how we started. Then when I think of like the other things that we approached, again, it kind of everything, the plan got turned on its head in the first 30 days. But I like to think about things from like a Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, I don't know if, you know, it's becoming more commonplace, I think, on the people space, but it's probably also because I was, you know, also a psych minor. So I love that stuff. So people typically tend to operate at that lowest need that's being met. So when you think about that hierarchy of needs, I think from a people perspective or people operations perspective, we think about it the same exact way. So at the most basic, people want to feel secure and safe. So whereas with like a traditional Maslow, you're thinking of like food, water, shelter, at a company, it's like payroll, benefits, right? So like Do you have, like, especially for younger startups, like, what's your benefits plan like? What's your payroll like? Is there consistency there? And then that next level, that safety level, right? Structure adds safety for people, right? People have so many different personalities, but there's a comfort in knowing how, you know, like, compensation is a huge, hairy, meaty subject, right? People want to know, when are they going to be eligible for merit increases? What does my bonus look like? Because all of those things are impacting their livelihood, right? Because the cash compensation that people make is directly impacting them, you know, today. And at the same time, too, it's the most direct way to show someone how they're valued, because they are literally being given a number for the work that they are doing. So you can feel good about the work that you're doing, but that is the clearest way to show people kind of like how you value them. So we start off with the DNA, and then the next thing came compensation strategy. And compensation strategy, again, because for me, that was a part that's like, it speaks to being equitable. It speaks to that safety and that security. And it was an opportunity to really let people know, like, how are we valuing people, right? Were we being consistent? Were we being fair? Because what I found is that, you know, it's not that some people, you know, when it comes to compensation, everyone probably wants to get paid more, right? But also people understand that companies pay differently. And if they understand that it's part of a holistic strategy, like, it's pretty well understood that if you're at an early stage startup, you probably will get less cash comp because they probably have less cash comp, but you might get more equity than you would at a large company, right? So for sure, people understand those trade-offs. So by having a unifying compensation strategy, not only were we able to kind of anchor back to something, so I could go back and say, hey, we are being equitable, because, you know, DEI is very, very important to me and has been very important to me for a long time. But not only that, like, I was able to clarify it with all the hiring managers. Everyone was able to understand it. And so even candidates, if they're talking to five different people, they're hearing the same thing. So they also know that no one's trying to pull the wool over their eyes. And then internally, it also made it easy to be really, really consistent. So yeah, so coming into Drizly, I would say the way I had thought I had prepared was not what I got when I came in, but that's how I started prioritizing things was, okay, let's start with the vision and that alignment, because I need to know where I'm going, and everything that I do is going to anchor back to that. And then I went to Maslow's and said, okay, compensation, that's how people feel most valued.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, definitely core values are critical to driving business decisions, and people decisions are business decisions. So it definitely makes sense that defining them was a core priority for you as you built your roadmap. I'd say especially this year through the pandemic and all of the changes we've been navigating, I see leaders really leaning on that long-term vision and their core values as they make these decisions on, you know, what trajectory to follow, when should we pivot, what do we pivot to, how do we support employees through this time, what don't we do, what will we never do. And so it all definitely comes hand in hand. And so, you know, you talked about how defining that mission and that vision and those values took some months. So what goes into an exercise like that? Like, how did you do it? How did you define those values?
Yeah, great question. And one thing before I move on, when you were talking about this year and like all of the things that are going on this year, like, this year was a perfect example of having to get back to basics and safety, right? Because people's health was at risk. And so all of a sudden you see people focus on different things. So when it comes to creating a vision, and you're going to hear me call it vision. I know vision's a very ubiquitous word, but when I'm thinking of vision, I'm thinking of purpose, values, mission all coming together. So, which is, you would know this, you know, I love frameworks. That's a Jim Collins. So I kind of bring it back to Jim Collins. He should get credit where credit's due. So first off, I don't think that this should be something that's owned by one person, right? If it's not something that's like really authentic to the company, and so in this case, to the founders of the company, I don't think it works. And also, I mean, when we started working on this, I think I'd been there for 4 or 5 weeks. So I also didn't, you know, it felt kind of presumptuous to be like, and I'm going to be the person that's deciding what your vision is or what your values are. So the way we went about it is, A, just even getting the stakeholders to understand why there was a need for it. Mm. Because again, at the senior level, they understood exactly what that strategy was. It just wasn't articulated anywhere within that framework. So I think A was getting buy-in for people to understand like why it would be important, why it was necessary, and kind of how we would go about it. When it came to, so there's lots of different exercises. I'm going to focus on values. So when I think of values, I like to focus on core values. And when I think of core values, that means that the way I define them is they are core to who you are today, right? And so if you're looking at a company that's been around 5 years, 10 years, even 2 years, thinking about what were some of those values that we've exhibited that got us to where we are today that we also believe are going to be key to getting us to where we need to be in the future. So it's kind of like enumerating those and really understanding those. I think the other one that I like to think of, like the other kind of almost what's the word? Like pressure test is, you know, when I think of other competitors, right? If, you know, the classic example that I love is I customer service is a very, very common core value, right? Lots of companies have the same core values. Would you say it's defensible that Nordstrom could say we offer better customer service than our competitors? Right? Probably. Yeah. Like Nordstrom is known for like having amazing customer service, right? So I think it's that. So when you have a core value, making sure that you can, that you could defend it, right? So if you say we're innovative, right? Because in tech companies, you're going to see a lot about service, integrity, innovation, right? Like those are kind of like the classic three. Can you really stand there and say, yeah, we can prove that we're more innovative than other companies? Like what's in your DNA? What are you doing that really showcases that? Mm-hmm. So I think making sure that they're core. The way we went about it, it's kind of like threefold. So A, I went to the founders and I said, even though you can't articulate what it means to be like a Drizly employee, right? That we couldn't articulate the values yet. Who are the people that as you look across the company, you would say, that's a person, that's a Drizly, like that's a core Drizly employee. So Drizly has three founders. So I asked each of the three founders to do that separately. Mm-hmm. And then I looked for overlaps in their list. And there were some times where the same person got mentioned three times by all three of them. There were some that it was just two. So we had a great conversation on why, you know, why did this make it on this list and not this? And I was able to hear a lot of the stories and the examples. Those people that were named, that I had at least two of the founders that named them, they became part of my focus group. So it was kind of a three-pronged approach. I did a company-wide survey, just asking people about values, just to see like what values naturally came up. So we asked the question a couple of different ways where people could fill in the blank and then they could do like a selection process. And then just kind of open-ended tell stories. And so I was able to distill the values from there. And that way the whole company was involved. Two, we did those focus groups. And so with the focus groups, I asked very intentional questions. And it was kind of like a really great working session around, you know, thinking about the highest moments or the biggest wins that we had had, the toughest times and what got you through those toughest times, and really trying to distill those down into specific values. And really, I think starting with storytelling, right? Like think about a time that you would say like, what was this experience, hard or positive, that really represents what it's like to be at Drizly? And values would kind of come out of that. And then once we had all of those data points, we were able to map those back and go back to the exact team. I thought we were going to have 3 to 5. I was really surprised that we only ended with 2, but it kept laddering up, right? It kept laddering up to those 2 things. And those felt so authentic to us. And it was something that we were like, this does feel authentic to just who we are as humans, right? And also was something that we were like, we're comfortable with this being a differentiating factor as we go into the future. So that was how we did the vision, the values part. The purpose statement, the way I think of purpose statement, that's your North Star. That is supposed to provide directional alignment. It's not something that you're ever trying to achieve. That's how I think of the mission. So the question we ask is like 100 years from now, you know, if everything we know changes, what would still be true, right? If Drizly's still around 100 years from now, like what's still true for us? And again, this was a lot of, you know, reflection, pair sharing, coming back together as a team. And so that was, you know, the founders and myself kind of going through it, but they really drove the discussion. I feel like my role there was just facilitating and they were the one driving it because they built the company, right? So it was around what was true for you then, what's still true for you now? What are those tenets that have like the common thread throughout? And so once we had it all together, you know, I feel like we got really close. Like we probably got in our first few meetings, 75% of the way there. And it was that last, like getting from 75% to like 85%, it slowed down tremendously. And then that last, you know, like 15% took months, right? Because that's when like you're intentional about each word, each nuance. You have to play with it. You have to sit with it. You have to test it. But yeah, that's how we went around about that process. It's very, very fun. And if anyone, you know, you or anyone listening wants to know more about it, don't ever hesitate to reach out. I'm more than happy to walk people through how I did it.
I love that approach. I think too often you kind of start thinking about who do we want to be? You end up with all of these aspirational values. And I think starting with who, you know, some of your core employees are, stories, what did we value in times of, you know, hardship? What did we think about when we made this tough decision? I think all of those are really who you are as a company. So I think reflecting on those stories is so important.
Well, and I think the aspirational values that you bring up, that's so important because, and again, I don't want to knock the RMV, but typically like a stereotype with the DMV or the RMV, whatever you call it, is that, actually, I won't tell you. What is a common stereotype of the DMV or the RMV?
That it's very slow.
Imagine if you walked in there and you saw on the wall that it was like, we put customers first. right? Like it's, I know people listening can't see your face, but your face said it all, right? And usually, yeah. And again, not knocking it, there's amazing humans that work in RMVs or DMVs. Right.
I'm going to spend my afternoon and maybe more here.
Exactly. And I think the employees know that too, right? The employees are sitting there saying like, no. So when you put something on a wall that's aspirational, what it does, if you're not super clear that it's aspirational and you're not really clear about the strategies that are going to get you there, mm-hmm. it just feels inauthentic. It feels disingenuous and it makes people, like it frustrates people, right? It's, I think it's the fastest way. When you have aspirational values, I think it's the fastest way to increase your turnover rate internally and to like annoy your customers or who you're going after. I think that it's you could add aspirations into your mission because that's something you're trying to achieve and clarifying that they're aspirational.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, it's pretty much a lose-lose situation when you have inauthentic values for both your employees and your people team, because as a people team, you don't really have a sense of what to focus and prioritize either. Like you have no North Star. And so I think it does a disservice to trust and transparency and clarity on all sides. So I completely agree. What are the core values that you landed on at Drizly? And are there any programs or initiatives that you're particularly proud of that you think represent some of those values?
Yeah. So our core values, we have two of them. They're We Care and We Solve It. And each of them break up into three different aspects. So We Care, it's, you know, we care for self. And the way we talk about that one is, you know, we hire adults at Drizly. We are very fast paced. While we've been around for 8+ years, it still kind of operates as like a scrappy startup. And the reason I think it's important to talk about that care for self is, you know, we have the additional, you know, benefits and perks like flexible time off and all of those different pieces. But really from day one, we tell people it's your responsibility to really own your path here from a, you know, because the work will always be there. So thinking about what do you need for balance, because, and in fact, I don't like calling it work-life balance. I think of it more as work-life harmony because it looks different for every person. Right. So what you might need, it might be different than what I need. And our lives change constantly as well. So you want it to be malleable. You want it to be flexible. So for me, it's more around, you know, when people think of caring for self, it's just telling them like, this is your responsibility. We want you to know when you need to like push back, to know when you need to push in, to know when to ask for help and to ask for that help, to kind of pioneer your own path and take control of your development, because no one is going to be as responsible for your path as you are. So we kind of start that from day one. That's the first one we talk about in onboarding. Then we say care for others. Others means end consumer, our retailer. So Drizly is where, you know, we're an alcohol marketplace. So we work with retailers. We, you know, have our end consumers. We work with different suppliers. So when we talk about care, we're talking about caring for all of our different customer groups and what that looks like, but also kind of caring for each other. And then the third is caring for the work. And this one I think is really important. I mean, we work with alcohol. Alcohol is a dangerous substance that, you know, that leads to very negative results sometimes. It can be a phenomenal substance that can enhance occasions. It can be a great thing, but it can also kill people, right? And I think sometimes I shock people in onboarding because I really hammer that in. They're like, oh, but I'm like, no, we need to understand that like this, you know, you don't want to be too cheeky and too fun and too glib because we have to have a certain responsibility with this. So I really like to hammer that in of like caring for the work. And caring for the work means also taking that pride in your work, but always remembering that this is a controlled substance. And with all the benefits that come from it, there's a lot of risk that comes from it. So kind of putting that on the forefront. And we talk about while We Care can feel very, very simple, there's actually a lot of meat to it. And then We Solve It is also broken up into three. And this one's a little bit more of a linear path, but like see it, figure it out, and then put it into action. You know, really encouraging people from day one, like ask questions, see the problems, ask us why, because it's so easy to go down the path of groupthink. It's so easy to kind of stick with status quo. But then it can be, you know, it's one thing to be the person that's pointing out the problems, but you want to be the person that's able to see the problems, but also is curious and wants to figure them out. Doesn't mean that you have to figure out alone, right? Figure out with the right people involved, but also trying to encourage that, you know, again, people figuring it out, because I think people develop there. They learn from that. It builds new partnerships. There's new ideas. It can be really, you know, bring about innovation. And then putting it into action, because there's some people that are really great at figuring out all these problems on their own, but then they might lack the aptitude to, or even the desire to move that forward, right? So when you put into action, you have to kind of like understand like what's, you know, how can I showcase like what's in it for them? How do I roll this out? How do I collaborate with other teams to get it there? So those are the Drizly values. When it comes to programs that we're really proud of, you know, there isn't one program that I would say this is like the end all be all program. I think that everything that we try to do touches upon those values. And what I'm proudest of isn't isn't when Drizly does something or when the people team does something. It's when I have other team members that are saying, hey, we really care and we solve it. So I had this idea to put this in place. When it's coming from the employees, because I don't want people to think that people operations owns culture. Culture is a living, breathing thing that everybody impacts. And when you think about people ops professionals, I mean, it's not like we're usually flush with resources and
Help us out.
Others do things, it's great. But what we have is, I know we have a really strong onboarding program, you know, which we really try to think about like the care and the solve, but it's really more around showcasing the DNA and how we do the work that we do. You know, we constantly, you know, and I think that we are definitely ahead of, you know, companies of our size and our tenure when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think it's because that comes from this idea of care and solve, and that's been core to who we are since 20, you know, just the last couple of years. But the way we approach things has been really focused and centered in that. Again, as I mentioned, our comp philosophy was anchored in that, where we say, okay, we care about people we solve. So how do we showcase that? So the statement is, we care for people while they're here. And what that means is we tell them, we're not going to try to like save someone, right? So I've worked at some companies where if you get internally promoted, that they put a cap on how much you can get that promotion by. So I've worked at some companies where that cap is like, oh, you can't go up more than 8% of your internal promotion. Well, what if the market for that role is different, right? You're almost punishing someone for longevity and for loyalty to a company. So for us, it was like, well, if we truly care about the employee, then we believe we should always pay what the work is worth. So because of that, doesn't matter if it's a huge jump, if they've earned that job and they've earned that role, then we're going to match the market. And whatever we would pay someone coming in externally, we'll pay our internal hires for that. So again, it's not like a one program that PeopleOps manages, but I would say everything that we've built, whether it's DEI, our CSR efforts, corporate social responsibility efforts, our compensation strategy, even how we do our employee relations issues. You know, a lot of companies were doing this, you know, thinking about caretaking for the fall with COVID, right? Mm-hmm. Like we really tried to approach it with that same philosophy. So we kept coming back and saying, okay, we're a business first. We recognize that people are our greatest assets. We care about people and we're trying to solve these things. So as we go about it, what are the best strategies that we can employ to do that?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you brought up compensation as part of your answer there, because I think, as you mentioned earlier, comp is literally like a numerical value that you're putting on your people. And so thinking through how you're going to reward and recognize your top talent, how you're thinking about bringing people into the organization and how you're supporting them there, of course, is a huge part of that value-driven work. And so I love the way that you're thinking about that. So I'm sure that we could talk all day, but one last question that I have for you before we wrap is, you know, we talked a lot about growth and introspection earlier in our conversation. And so I'm curious, as, you know, an HR leader, someone that's done a lot of this work in the past, is there anywhere that you go or anything that you do to continue your own ongoing learning and development, whether it's kind of learning what the latest and greatest is in the field or, you know, even just kind of focusing on developing, you know, your own skill set as a leader? Is there anything that you do and find helpful?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think all of the above. So this has also been a crazy time with, you know, with COVID. I know a lot of people are looking for different ways of just staying, you know, grounded. I think for me, one of my challenges is that so my children are older, so my work-life harmony looks a lot different. And so it's very easy for me to get caught up into work and not take a break. So for me, it's things that I think typically get labeled as self-care, you know, some yoga, you know, mindfulness exercises, meditation. And I think for me, it's because you may have to slow it down the podcast because I've been told I talk very, very quickly. So hopefully you have that ability, but my mind is always going, like I'm always going really, really quickly. So I find that those exercises and those practices help me slow down a bit because when I'm able to slow down, I'm able to just think about things differently. I think the other thing that I do is I read books, all kinds of books. You know, like right now, my daughter's telling me about a book that she loves that honestly sounds intriguing. So I'm going to read that, even though it's like this sci-fi young adult book. But I find that regardless, even if it's like fiction, nonfiction, history, like I love reading history books, you're always getting different perspectives and that can shape how you see the world. And if you're opening yourself up to those connections, you could be reading something that has absolutely nothing to do with a work issue and it unlocks something for you. And then I think podcasts, I love listening to podcasts about all kinds of things. And again, I think that hearing different people's perspectives, especially if you give yourself space to like let it percolate, then all of a sudden you can come up with like different pieces. Then I think networking. There's a lot more, I think, networking opportunities for people in the people operations space than there were 5-10 years ago. And then I have my own little, you know, like a monthly happy hour with some people ops friends. And I feel like we keep each other just kind of centered. You asked about people that inspire me. I mean, honestly, there's so many. I think the thing about me is I get inspired by a lot of people. So, I mean, there's the classics, right? Like I love Brené Brown, you know, who doesn't love Brené? There's some just really phenomenal authors out there. There's great books out there. But I also get inspired by, like, you know, hearing the stories of some of these brand new hires that we're bringing in, their entry level. And you hear about, like, just like the courage that they have in their lives, right? Like, just people have such unique stories, and so many people are going through such difficult times right now. So I think those things inspire me as well. So there's not kind of one go-to place, but I would say, you know, an HBR, like if I ever need like a good resource, I'd probably go to like HBR, the Stanford Review. Like there's some classic publications that I go to. So yeah.
Yeah, I really like your point of just having more experiences and perspectives in your life, whether that's through actual interactions or reading other books. At the end of the day, our jobs are just to support people. So frameworks and TED Talks can only get you so far. You really just need to get out there and spend time with other humans. So I really appreciate your take on that. I also think it's super endearing to hear that the stories of other employees really inspire you. And I have to say, I definitely feel the same way. Like a manager will say something and or, you know, they'll do something for their team. And yes, I have the role in coaching other managers and employees in the organization, but I'm constantly learning so much from my broader team. So I'm right there with you. Great. Well, Gabriella, I really appreciate you taking time to come on the show. It's always so fun chatting with you and, you know, really cool stories that you have to share around how Drizly defined their core values and their mission, and how you thought about building leadership trainings for managers by focusing on a solid, tried and true curated set of frameworks and best practices, but then really doubling down on the reflection and discussion that you've leaded with them. So a lot to think about as we jump into this year with our team. So thank you for sharing your story and your experiences. This was fun.
Thank you so much, Rasika. It's so great seeing you again. And I'm just so excited for you and what you're building.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to hear more stories like this, please subscribe for the weekly drop and feel free to share around with your people and talent colleagues. I'd love your feedback, so please leave a review and let us know what you enjoyed and what types of topics you'd like to see covered in the future. The more reviews and subscribers we get, the more quality content we can consistently deliver to you. If you're interested in being on the podcast, feel free to reach out to me at rasika@engageandempower.org. See you next week.